On today's College Football Inquirer, what is next for the college football playoff? A deadline looms on Friday. Plus, Duke quarterback Darian Mensah does not want to be Duke quarterback Darian Mensah anymore. Duke is now suing quarterback Darian Mensah to keep him from transferring, we think, to Miami. Plus, a very strange eligibility story in the world of college basketball. There's a chance that a dude who played in the G League last year could play for Alabama on Saturday. Yep, it just gets weirder and weirder. We'll talk about it all on today's College Football Inquirer. This is the College Football Inquirer with Ross Dellinger. I am Andy Staples. Stephen Godfrey's on a vision quest, and we can't wait to hear what he's learned on Tuesday. Ross, you are still in Miami Beach. You could not get enough
of
the South Florida weather.
That's right. As I'm staring out the window and it's pouring rain, but at least it's 70 degrees and not 20 degrees. Like everybody's bracing for the snow and ice, I think, in most of the eastern continental U.S. But it's at least warm here, but it has been rainy and windy. Having a good time. Still in Miami.
Let's talk about our experience in Miami Beach over the weekend, because I think that is very instructive, and it ties into what is coming on Friday. And what is coming on Friday is a deadline set by the folks at ESPN for the college football playoff, for the commissioners who run the college football playoff, to decide on a format for 2026. I know what you're saying, but Ross and Andy, we're already 22 days into 2026. How do they not know this already?
Yeah.
Well, Ross, I'm going to let you take it from here.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I don't really know why they, continue to sort of drag this on, because it's pretty clear that they're not going to come to some kind of consensus. Greg Sankey and Tony Petitti have to agree on a format for one to go forward in. Right now they're sort of at an impasse, and I don't think that anything over the next day or so is going to change that. In fact, I think there's some people that even thought last week that the CFP would just make an announcement or release a statement saying that they're going to stay, at 12. And that's what I expect to happen at some point on Friday, barring some kind of unforeseen compromise. And that compromise was, as we talked about on the show, there's been a sort of a compromise discussed of moving to 16 for 2 or 3 years, and then having a sort of an agreement to move then to 24 starting in a certain year, 2028, 2029, something like that. But there's not, I think the Big Ten wants a guarantee of that 24 move to 24 teams. And I think the SEC is unwilling to make such a guarantee. So we're kind of at a stalemate. And look, I mean, Andy, I think me and you talked about this up in the press box at the game. We bumped into some people down on the field pregame, and they kind of said, hey, why isn't Tony Petitti taking more heat on the playoff stuff, because it's basically 10 versus 1. All the 10 conferences in Notre Dame want 16, and he's standing in the way. But you know what? The Big Ten side, right, is the other thing. Why isn't Greg Sankey taking more heat? Because we're just trying to expand the field to have more more opportunities for all the conferences. And so it's just been this back and forth. And I wrote a story on Sunday about the Big Ten and SEC. We could talk about that later, like the fallout of their sort of relationship.
Well, so it's become a PR battle. And here's what I will tell all the executives that we talked to on either side of this over the weekend and at the national championship game. Stop worrying about who gets the most blame for it. It doesn't matter. Basically, everybody is going to support their own team on this. So fans of Big Ten schools are going to support Tony Petitti on this. Fans of SEC schools are going to support Greg Sankey on this. They're going to vilify Tony Petitti. The Big Ten people are going to vilify Greg Sankey. That's what happens when you create a situation where there are two people who have fairly equal power and neither one has a lot of leverage over the other, and yet they are diametrically opposed on an issue. You get a stalemate like this. You get one side saying it's all the other guy's fault, even though it is both of their faults. And,
yeah.
You know, if I'm Greg Sankey, I of course I'm going to say, but everybody else agrees with me.
Right.
And
right.
If I'm Tony Petitti, I'm going to go, but everybody else should agree with me.
Right.
Because that, I can make it better for some of them.
Yeah. I mean, it's really, you know, the 2014 model that has been thrown around, the format model, right? It would be four automatic qualifiers for each of the four power conferences, two spots for the group of six, and six at large. I mean, there's been a lot of formats talked about, but that's the one of the 24.
Well, and that's a compromise in and of itself, because initially,
yeah,
the bigger, the more automatic bids went to the Big Ten and the SEC, and they had more in the formats we saw before than the Big 12 and the ACC. And that's why the Big 12 and the ACC before the season were like, no, we want more at larges. We need to earn it ourselves, because they were in a position where, And I agreed with, like, Brett Yormark talked about this a lot before the season. I agreed with him and some of the Big 12 ADs I talked to about it. They couldn't codify their own inferiority to the SEC and the Big 10, even though they kind of already have, and we'll get to that in a second. But they couldn't do that in terms of bids. And so that the Big 10 would be willing to throw that out there. Now, that's also something, if I'm the SEC, I would push back on. So I get where they're coming from. I think 24 teams is a terrible idea, because I think it takes you out of that sweet spot. Because right now they're in a sweet spot where there are a lot of late season games that matter. It does actually enhance the regular season. I do think if you've got 24 teams getting in, I don't know that the regular season is as much fun.
Yeah, well, you certainly, especially like early mid-season, you start to strip away the value of some of those games. But you probably put more, there's probably an increase in value in some of the later November games that normally wouldn't have value, I guess, for that fourth spot or so. Thing is like, and there's a few like branches I want to go down here. And one is, I keep getting this question is, well, what do the other nine entities on the board really want? Well, publicly, most of them have said they want 16 publicly, right? The group of six conference commissioners, Jim Phillips and Brett Yormark, publicly, in Pete Bevacqua of Notre Dame's AD, publicly have said that they want 16. But if Greg Sankey were to all of a sudden just say, you know what, yeah, 24 is good, let's talk more about that, you know, I think that, again, just because of what we just said, it opens a path for so many more teams to get into the playoffs from these other leagues, it would be 24, right? They would be on board with 24.
Right. They would jump to that, but right now they're back in the horse they think is going to win.
Sort of, yeah. And I think also they're backing the model that doesn't wholesale change everything in college football, right? Because like, if you go to 24, the bowls already, right, or have been adversely impacted. If you go to 2014,
right,
I don't know how the bowls exist. I don't know how, at the power conference level, at least, I don't know how the power conference level bowls that have tie-ins continue to exist. You have to also get rid of conference championship games, which is probably going to happen eventually, but you'd have to get rid of them immediately, basically, for a 2014. So but, it's just a lot
is,
of this
I mean,
change,
that's what this 24 team is, though, isn't it, Ross?
It's a play-in,
to get those play-in games to replace the conference championship games, because that is... That's Tony Petitti's baby. Tony Petitti, remember, is a former television executive. Like, this is his big idea. So, and I'll say this in fairness to Petitti. It's a good idea, the play-in games. Like, they would be fun.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't like what they would do to the rest of the games before that.
Yeah. Andy, one thing I think in this 2014 idea that is, to me, a positive is, the specific thing is, instead of having a conference championship game where you're playing yourself, right, in a game that's like a semifinal game, it's basically a 1-3 or 2-5 or whatever. I mean, it's a game against top 10, top five, matching top 10, top five teams, instead of playing yourself one more game, you play somebody else, right? You play another league. I mean, it makes a that part I do get. I do sort of understand that. I think the playing games would be really exciting, and probably down the line, guess what? We'll probably get there eventually, right? We're going to get there eventually. But as I said, and I've said on the show so much, like, college sports doesn't walk, it crawls, and we're just going to crawl there. And so I think one other thing I want to talk about with this whole issue is, and I should say, I mentioned Notre Dame in some of the Group of Six conferences, and Jim Phillips and Brett Yormark, and all of them maybe getting on board with the 2014 publicly if Greg Sankey would. But here's the thing. I think a lot of them also have reservations. I know a lot of their ADs do, especially in the ACC and Big 12, for what you talked about, Andy, is just this wholesale change and the impact this has in the regular season. I still think there's some drawback in that. So let me give you some insight of what happened in the room, by the way, because I don't think this has been written mm-hmm. about, and I haven't talked about it yet.
Right. And we're talking about this past weekend, Sunday.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Sunday at the, where were we? Lowe's Hotel on Miami Beach is where the CFP leaders
nice hotel.
All stayed.
Great coffee.
Very nice. Yeah. Very good coffee. Yeah. And they had us in our little sort of holding area, which is a floor above the meeting space. But so let's take our listeners through Sunday. So at 7 a.m., in sort of a meeting room down the hall that few people knew about, I think, the Power Conference commissioners in their football sort of deputies, administrators met. And that was the real, Andy, you could say that was the real meeting from 7 to 10:30 a.m. Mm-hmm. on Sunday. And that's where they didn't come to some resolution. And then at 10:30, from 10:30 to 12, the four of them, commissioners, met with the other six commissioners in Notre Dame's athletic director in the CFP management committee room. And so going around the room, they got to format and they went around the room. The presidents were in there too. So each of the corresponding presidents on the board were in there as well. So you had roughly 25 people, some CFP staff. They went around the room, and I think Jim Phillips and Brett Yormark raised the paddle for 16. Greg mm-hmm. Sankey, as he normally does, right, didn't necessarily throw out a number or specifically talk about a format, but talked around it, right? But everybody knew where he stood.
He always trots out the line. We would have been fine staying at four. He probably said
four.
That.
Yeah. And then, lastly, they got to Tony Petitti, and he raised the paddle for 16 and then raised the paddle for 24, right, and with this compromise proposal. Wanting, let's go 2 or 3 years at 16, and then let's move to 24. And there was some discussion on how to write the language to the compromise. Hey, we'll use best good faith efforts. We'll negotiate in good faith in 3 years to move to whatever. But there wasn't guarantee language. And I think that was stopping the Big Ten from getting on board because they want to guarantee this is going to move. And look, the other side says, hey, we don't know what's going to happen in 3 days in college athletics, let alone 3 years. Why would we give a guarantee? So that failed. And like we said, I mean, we're sitting here taping this at 10 a.m. on Thursday. I would expect a Friday announcement that they will remain at 12 teams.
I would too. Your story, by the way, on the Big Ten and the SEC being at loggerheads here is excellent. And I'll highlight one quote from it. Everybody needs to go to yahoo.com and read this story from Ross anyway. But talking about the idea of an agreement, talking about the idea of figuring out a new postseason format. And you ask the question, is an agreement really possible? And the next quote you use is from Tim Pernetti, the American commissioner. That's up to two people in the room. And I think that's what we need to make sure we explain to everybody here. I think most of our audience understands that, but I want to make sure everybody knows. The way this used to work is that essentially the commissioners of the FBS conferences and Notre Dame all had fairly equal weight to their votes. Some people would have more leverage than others, but the votes were weighted fairly similarly. Even when there was a clear distinction between the power conferences and the not power conferences. But this has been codified within the last few years. You've reported on this pretty thoroughly, that it is the Big Ten and the SEC that will decide what comes next. It is not anybody else. They have pretty much exclusive control over this, even though the other commissioners are still, you know, in the meetings. But that's what's kind of weird about this, Ross.
Yeah,
you have these people like, you know, yeah, the Tim Pernettis and Brett Yormarks and Jim Phillips of the world, like they're in the room, but there's not really anything they can do.
Yeah, let's get into explaining, because there's a lot of, pregame on the field, this came up. And at Lowe's, I ran into somebody at the hotel, and this came up too, of like, hey, explain this to me. Well, how does this work? Why do these two, Big Ten and SEC, have the sole authority over the formatting? What is going on? You know, no matter how many times I write about it, it's a 2 years old. People don't understand. So let's explain what happened. So spring of 2024, so almost 2 years ago, next month, actually, it was a big meeting of all the CFP commissioners, conference commissioners, and Notre Dame's AD, the 11 entities that make up the CFP board. And basically, the Big Ten and SEC walked in that meeting and said, if you don't give us this and this and this, we are breaking away and doing our own playoff. And people don't, you know, and I've gotten people, I think it was last spring, Andy, I wrote like a detailed sort of how this happened, played out, and people went on the record, right? Presidents of other schools went on the record and said they threatened to leave. I think Mike Oresco, I have going on the record saying we should have let them go. I believe I have to go back and look, but Mike Oresco is one of those ones, a former American commissioner who wanted to just say, screw you guys, we're calling your bluff, right? But everybody didn't agree.
Mike Oresco, retired now, by the way, can say that.
He was on his way out then, I think. And so he could kind of be that guy in the room, I think, that said, you know, hey, we're gonna call your bluff. They didn't do that, obviously. And so they gave the SEC and Big Ten what they wanted. And number one, what they gave them was money, right? The Big Ten and SEC combined get 58% of revenue starting next year from future college football, the playoff pot. They get basically each 29% of the playoff pot, which is different from previous, where each power league got like 16 or 17% of a cut. So they gave them money. And number two, they gave them sole authority on future format, but with some language in the MOU, the infamous MOU that was signed that codified all this, with some language that said they have to have meaningful conversation, consultation, whatever, with all the other leagues before they decide something. So that's basically what happened. And that leads us to where we are. I had one commissioner who was interesting after my story ran on sort of the Big Ten and SEC fallout. And we could talk about that also a little more detail or next segment or whatever we want to do. But because I think it's essential to what's going on in college athletics, not just playoff, but a lot of other things, is that the SEC and Big Ten all of a sudden are just sort of going different ways a little bit on several issues. But I had a commissioner tell me when I sort of questioned him about, hey, you guys decided to do this 2 years ago and give them all this authority. And now look, you're sort of stuck because of it. And he said, you know, when we decided to do that, we didn't think about the one thing that's happening. They don't agree. Like we didn't think that they would have this falling out and just suddenly, you know, wouldn't agree with one another. Because if that happens, it's happening now, obviously, there you're stuck. Yep. You're kind of stuck in the rut. So that's where we are. And again, the divide that's happened, right? Just 10 months ago or 11 months ago, the SEC and Big Ten ADs were meeting in New Orleans in a joint meeting. It was their second joint meeting in the previous 4 months. It came about a year or so after they announced this partnership with one another. And they were just cohesive on a lot of issues. They were going to do this, you know, the 4-4-2-2 playoff format. You know, everything was sort of aligning to have this happen, to have them together, this marriage. And then, no, right? I think they just sort of have drifted apart. And it started with that 4-4-2-2 playoff format that they were discussing last spring. Kind of, you know, the Big Ten was on board with it. even the SEC athletic administrators were sort of on board with a 16-team playoff with a 4-4-2-2.
And then the SEC coaches said.
And then Greg Sankey met with the SEC coaches in Destin. They rejected the idea. They wanted a bigger at-large pool. And that really started, I think, the decline of sort of the relationship. And this doesn't mean, I want to be clear, because after my story, I heard from some feedbacks from some people who weren't very happy. And I understand, because I think they believe that I made it look like they're not talking at all, right? They're never going to talk or never going to agree again. That's not the case, right? They talk. Greg Sankey and Tony Petitti still talk. They just, their leagues clearly are not as aligned on many issues as they were just a few months ago. That is obvious, right? And I can go through them, right? Playoff format, the athlete compensation enforcement with the College Sports Commission, transfer portal time in the calendar, college football calendar, and private equity. All those things they are not aligned on, just at least right now or as of the last few months, they have not been aligned on. And for college football, Andy, what does that mean? It means everything's sort of stuck in a rut.
Yes, because we talk about like a super league is the next obvious step. Well, not if the two leagues that would be the backbone of the super league can't agree on anything. So that may be a good thing for those of us who don't want to see a super league.
Mm.
But it is very interesting because Kevin Warren, the former Big Ten commissioner, who's now the president of the Chicago Bears, he and Greg Sankey did not get along.
Yeah.
They did not see eye to eye. I'm putting it mildly.
Right. Yeah, there was not a lot of communication between the two of them. There's
correct.
Communication between Tony Petitti and Greg Sankey, even if they disagree on things. There's communication. As you mentioned, yeah, there was no, Carly, no communication between Greg Sankey and Kevin Warren.
So the hope was that these two superpowers would get along better when Tony Petitti took over, and they did get along better.
Yeah.
As you mentioned, coming in arm in arm, lockstep, to wrest control of the CFP away from everybody else with the threatened breakaway, that sort of thing. They were acting in concert at that point. And as you pointed out, it did fall apart. And it's interesting because I think what you just mentioned, it's not just the playoff. It is essentially a fundamental disagreement over how this is all going to work. And I think you see, like, the Big Ten is doing some things, and we're going to talk about the Big Ten's uniform contract for NIL deals in our next segment when we talk about Darian Mensa and when I bring up Damon Williams, the Washington quarterback who did not leave because the contract that was written by the Big Ten kind of held up. And they are essentially the central payer of the athletes, which suggests to me that they have a plan for how all this is going to work moving forward. And I'm not sure Greg Sankey agrees with that plan. So this is going to continue. And I do wonder, Ross, where do you think they can come back together? Is there an issue that maybe they will find common ground on that they can come back together on?
Yeah, I think there are a few. I think that SEC is probably coming along to believing, you know what, maybe the Big Ten was right about the timing of the portal. You know, the Big Ten wanted the portal in the spring,
April,
to align with the academic calendar and the rev share sort of year. And I think a lot of people in the SEC are sort of like, maybe we should do that, given what's happened, just this January portal playing out in the middle of the playoff. So they could end up coming together on that. They could, I guess, end up coming together on the whole enforcement of the CSC, not to get too detailed into that, but the SEC president signed the College Sports Commission participation agreement in June, and they've been waiting for everybody else to sign. And two, three modified agreements have been produced, and the Big Ten just hasn't, along with several other leagues, hasn't signed it. So they could come around to signing a modified agreement, but any modified agreement probably pulls from the agreement its teeth, which is allowing the CSC to enforce without being sued by the schools. So we'll see if they can come to grips on that. I don't see any any compromise or agreement anytime soon on the playoff format. And I don't even know, Andy, why, if you're the Big Ten, you just won three straight national titles. Why do you want to change what's going on right now? You know, like, why do you think about
that?
I mean, there are
well
reasons. Yeah. I mean, there are reasons, right?
Yeah.
You give a path to more of your schools. You have 18 schools and you give a path to more of your schools. And I understand that part of it. You open up more inventory for other networks, mm-hmm. say like Big Ten partner, Fox, ahem, right? And Eric Shanks, Fox Sports, he has gone on the record and said that he's in support of the 2014 playoff out in LA in an event last December or last month. So I get that. But yeah, I don't think they come to an agreement on format. And I don't know that they come to an agreement sort of on the need for private equity either.
No, the private equity one, the SEC people seem pretty well entrenched. And let's be real, some Big Ten schools are too. So it's not that is a disagreement that will continue within the Big Ten itself. So yeah, we'll see how these guys go moving forward. But we expect they will keep the playoff at 12 because they probably can't come up with a solution by tomorrow, which if they did, that'd be a hell of a Ross Dellinger story to read. So, but I don't expect it. So hopefully, Ross, you can actually enjoy your final few hours in South Beach.
Indeed.
But we got to talk about somebody who's trying to get where you are, who's trying to get to Miami. When we come back, the saga of Darian Mensah, the Duke quarterback, who'd like to transfer to Miami, but now Duke is suing him. We'll be right back. We are back to College Football Inquirer, and if you'd like to watch us on the College Football Inquirer, not just listen to us, then turn on your smart TV. Check out your home screen. You should see a Yahoo Sports Network icon. You click on that, you got all the shows from the Yahoo Sports Network. Or if you're on your phone, on your tablet, on your laptop, on the go, or anywhere, go to yahoosports.tv and you can watch all the Yahoo Sports Network shows 24/7, 365, anytime you want, on demand, yahoosports.tv. Ross, we got to talk about something else that is the buzz of everybody in college sports, because we're gonna hit a couple of these, but we'll start with the football one. Darian Mensah, the quarterback at Duke. We found out on Friday of last week, which was, by the way, the day that the transfer portal closed, or at least the last day you could enter your name into it or asked to enter your name into it. We found out that Darian Mensah, who led Duke to an ACC title in his first year at Duke after transferring from Tulane, wanted to enter the portal. The supposition was that he wanted to enter the portal so that he could go to Miami, which had been casting about for a transfer portal quarterback and seemed to have landed on Mensah. Duke, understandably, was very upset about this. Darian Mensah, when he transferred from Tulane, signed a two-year deal with the Blue Devils, a two-year NIL deal, and he played out the first year of it and was about to enter year two of it. So now Duke suing Mensah in Durham County Court in North Carolina, trying to get an injunction that keeps him from transferring. And I find this very interesting, Ross, because we watched this situation somewhat play out with Damon Williams Jr., the Washington quarterback, who said he wanted to enter the transfer portal. But then, you know, he hired a lawyer. His team reviewed the situation. Washington said, hey, you know, we'll take every legal remedy we can to enforce the contract. And after examining the contract, examining the situation, Damon Williams decided to stay at Washington, which suggests to me that he was advised that the contract has some teeth, and LSU, which was the school we thought might want him, for him and for LSU, the juice might not be worth the squeeze. With Mensah, to me, Ross, it seems like his team is much more confident that they can get him out of Duke and to Miami. And the latest update, and I'm by latest, I mean latest, because we're recording this at 10 a.m. Eastern on Thursday morning. Mensah went in the portal officially. Duke put his name in the portal basically right before the clock struck midnight on Thursday. Yeah. They had to do that. But as part of this suit, the judge has said, Darian Mensah, you cannot enroll in another school or join another football team until after we have a hearing about this. And that hearing is scheduled for February 2nd, though Mensah's team's trying to move it up. This is going to be really interesting to see how this shakes out.
It is. Gosh, you know, Andy, pulling back for a second, the 30,000 foot view of the sort of legal landscape right now that we're seeing in this new era. We've got Duke suing its quarterback. We've got Ole Miss's quarterback suing the NCAA. We've got
in
Georgia
court, as opposed to federal. Yeah. Yep, with a home field advantage. Yep.
Yeah, Georgia suing its former defensive lineman who's at rival Missouri, and that defensive lineman suing Georgia.
He's in the portal.
I believe, right?
He might wind up in Miami too.
He's in the portal. He's back in the portal. Great. Yes. Look, I missed that. I mean, it's amazing. And then we'll get to that in the next segment about all the eligibility. That's not even counting all the eligibility stuff. So. It's fascinating, and these are the you might say growing pains of a new world where you you don't have the rules and regulations that would come with a collective bargaining agreement, for instance, or some kind of federal legislation or antitrust legislation. So because of that, here we are. Going back to the DeMond issue with Washington and potentially LSU was the landing spot. I think there is a thought, at least from the Duke side, that this situation is going to resolve sort of like that one. It doesn't appear that to be the case, because you would think if that were the case, it would have happened already, that he would have announced that.
Well, the same attorney who advised DeMond is also representing Mensah.
Right.
Yeah, so he was involved in both of these cases, and we saw what DeMond chose ultimately. Now, Darren's not going to tell you exactly what he told DeMond, but if you read the tea leaves on this, they looked at that contract from Washington, which was written by the Big Ten, which, by the way, learned its lesson after dealing with another Darren Heitner client who was trying to transfer to Miami. That would be Xavier Lucas, the Miami quarterback who transferred from Wisconsin last year.
Yeah.
They added some teeth to that contract. Or not teeth. They just added some specific language that made it a little bit easier to defend. And that's what's interesting to me is, you know, we talk about schools say they need Congress to pass a bill. We talk about they could collectively bargain with the athletes and have rules that they could enforce. They also could just not change anything. And probably write a little more precise contracts, and it would probably keep some of this movement down. Because what happened with Xavier Lucas last year is he had made a deal with Wisconsin, and that was also on a contract that the Big Ten writes and allows all its schools to use. But that contract was not specific about enrolling in another school constitutes a breach of the contract. So Wisconsin refused to put Xavier Lucas in the transfer portal. And Xavier Lucas said, that's fine. I withdraw and I'm enrolling at Miami. Wisconsin then sued Miami for tortious interference, but has taken no legal action against Xavier Lucas and will not take any legal action against him. So the Big Ten learned. And the contract, I'm told, that DeMond Williams signed said, if you enroll in another school, you are breaching this contract and therefore will owe damages to Washington.
Yeah.
Now, we've seen the Darian Mensah contract. The only thing we haven't seen are the amounts on it, but you've reported that it's worth $4 million a year because it was attached as an exhibit in this lawsuit. And so now we've seen it. There isn't any specific language in that says enrolling in another school breaches the contract. All it says is if he enrolls in another school, Duke doesn't have to pay him. So I think that is where the confidence is coming from on the Mensa side.
Yeah. And, you know, there's obviously in sort of an easy way that this gets resolved, and that's some kind of financial settlement, right, between the schools.
Which I think is what's probably going to happen.
You would think, right? Like, yeah, I mean, that's probably the most likely scenario. But there really, as of yesterday, there hasn't been any, like, formal discussion between the schools. But partly that's true because he wasn't actually in the portal, right? And so now he's in the portal. So if there is some kind of agreement between Miami and Mensa to make this happen, you would think maybe there would be some discussion over a financial settlement, because I think Mensa Mensa/Miami would be open to, you know, paying some kind of buyout of some sort to so that Duke will release him from the contract. Now, any buyout would, you know,
Miami
count
AD
again.
Dan Radakovich says it should be uncapped anyway.
Uncapped, right. Yes.
Wouldn't affect their cap number anyway. So
Right. That's another whole story that sort of came out late last week here in Miami from Dan Radakovich and some other athletic directors at fairly prominent schools, saying that the cap should be lifted because we don't have enforcement right now. And so either you have enforcement or just lift the cap. And one of them obviously prominently was, as you mentioned, is Dan Radakovich of Miami. And based on those comments, you would think that, yeah, they would be fine with just paying some kind of financial settlement. But any buyout they do pay would be counted against, you know, next year's revenue share pool that Miami would have available. But again, you know, we talked about this a few weeks ago with my story on the LSU and the Playfly and how schools are using multimedia rights to go over the cap. I don't know how big of a penalty these reductions are in the rev share, because schools are just continually exceeding it in different ways. And it'll be fascinating this spring, Andy, and this summer, when some of these deals that have been guaranteed to athletes arrive at the College Sports Commission's NIL Go clearinghouse and get kicked out or sort of remain in limbo under review. The athletes are at risk of being deemed ineligible.
Now, one thing that seems to be, at least anecdotally, when there's corporate money behind those deals, they seem to get through. And there's one particular company that I think might be involved here that seems pretty willing to, write checks to make sure the best players play for the schools that wear it. And that would be Adidas. And it was interesting. There was a guy on the sideline the other night at the national championship game, which, by the way, was the first all Adidas national championship game. Indiana and Miami are both Adidas schools. And he was wearing a half Miami jersey, half Indiana jersey. I'm like, who in the world is this? Is this there's not a parent who has somebody on both teams. No, it was the CEO of Adidas. Mm-hmm. And so we can go back to the federal case against all the college basketball coaches. We know Adidas has no problem going out and getting the best players and making sure they play at Adidas schools. So if I were Miami, I really wouldn't be worried about this, because I'm guessing three stripes would take care of it, because I don't think the CSC is going to kick back an Adidas deal, if that's what it comes to.
Well, that is a big question, right? Is a lot of administrators are asking. We've seen a lot of multimedia rights deals with the Playflies, the Learfields, get through the clearinghouse. Basically, these entities working to pair athletes with corporate sponsors, and a lot of that stuff has gotten through. What we haven't seen yet, I think, is the big apparel contracts get through, and we're gonna see about that. And Adidas has been, as you mentioned, Andy, much more aggressive. I would say than counterpart Nike.
Nike has been fairly niche in terms of which athletes it signs to an exclusive shoe and apparel deal. It's not. It hasn't been like you'd think, they're just going to sign Arch Manning. They actually didn't. Like, Vori signed Arch Manning to an apparel deal. It's been more targeted, where it's athletes in different sports, and you know, a lot of times they have a really great story behind them, but it's not necessarily just the best player at a Nike school. And I feel like Adidas will be more kind of just, hey, this is a good player in one of our schools.
Well, and then and I think I've been sort of digging into this matter because it's pretty fascinating, because Adidas has been significantly more aggressive than Nike with sort of helping schools exceed the cap, you might say. And I was like digging into why. And, you know, the reason I think Nike is not going as far with some of these things is, Andy, Nike represents, not that Adidas doesn't, but Nike represents all these pro athletes and other athletes, Olympic athletes. Mm-hmm. It changes the scale, the bottom line of what they're offering all their athletes. And I think the Nike folks have mentioned that to many college administrators. Look, we can't pay your quarterback, you know, $800,000 for an NIL deal. We don't pay somebody in the NFL $800,000 for an NIL deal. And so we need to stay on scale. But as one college administrator told me, we had to tell Nike, yo, we got boosters. This is an inflated market. This is how it works. But that doesn't do anything.
Right. And you tell Nike, hey, if you don't want to do this, we can always go to Adidas. And you've seen some moves to Adidas.
We've seen it happen.
And
yeah.
Yep. And the other part of it is Nike is dominant in the American sports apparel and shoe market. It dominates Adidas. Now, Adidas is big worldwide because it's a European brand. It is mostly attached to soccer. But in America, where Adidas would like to have a larger market share, Nike is completely bigfooting everybody. So Nike also doesn't need it as bad as Adidas does.
Right. Well, that's the thing. You know, and there's a similar thing playing out with kind of Learfield in Playfly, right? One's being probably more aggressive than the other. And it's, I think it's the reason behind that is you've got somebody sort of more at the top of the market in each of these multimedia mm-hmm. rights and apparel, right? The biggest one is Learfield is the biggest MMR partner for schools right now. They represent more schools than anybody. And Nike is the brand of Nike historically is at the top, right? And each of these other entities, maybe Playfly in the multimedia rights world and Adidas in the apparel world, are sort of trying to catch up with the entity above them. And how to do that? Be more aggressive, right? And that's what we're seeing. So it's going to be fascinating. You know, I'll say a bit about this, a little news nugget here that I mentioned in my story with LSU and Playfly and that contract that LSU offered Brendan Sorsby through Playfly, $3.5 million. The conference commissioners and their corresponding presidents, the four of them, the four power conference commissioners and four presidents that sit on the College Sports Commission board, they have been discussing guardrails, our favorite word, Andy, guardrails, around the redirection of revenue from multimedia rights partners. And they haven't arrived at any, I don't think, final language or rule or policy, but it has definitely been under discussion along with apparel deals.
And they're not going to arrive at anything, or if they'll arrive at something and it'll get sued into oblivion, because that is what happens here. Like, we know how the story ends, but they're going to keep banging their head against the same concrete wall if we let them. This Mensa thing, one other little nugget to add to that. Also on Wednesday, so Mensa goes into the portal officially at 11:55 p.m. Eastern time on Wednesday. He was not the only Duke star offensive player who hit the portal on Wednesday. And mind you, this is 5 days after the deadline for everybody to say they're entering. Cooper Barkate, their star receiver this year, who had transferred from Harvard the year before, he also is now in the portal. And Miami is listed as a school to watch for him, although Cooper Barkate was a really productive player, and I'm sure there's going to be some other schools that want him. But that's another interesting thing. And Cooper Barkate, really, just he's a wild story in general. From Newport Beach, had plenty of interest from power conference schools coming out of high school, elected to go to Harvard because Harvard. And his dad told my podcast partner at On3, Ari Wasserman, an anecdote when Ari wrote a story about Cooper during his high school recruitment. And the dad said he took Cooper to his first NFL game. And Cooper says, "Oh, wouldn't it be cool to be one of those players on the field?" And the dad says, "Wouldn't it be cool to be one of those people in the owner's box?" And Cooper getting a full tour of higher education in the business of college sports in his career.
Yeah, I visited Duke in August to do the story on Mensa, and one of the players they interviewed was Cooper. Man, like, what a really impressive person. Just you could tell why he went to Harvard and how he went to Harvard. It was an impressive conversation. It's funny to see what's happening since then, right? Just 4 or 5 months ago when I visited there, and everybody was so excited at Duke about having Darian and having Cooper. And look, they won the ACC, although they lost 5 games, they won the ACC championship. And now you've got both of them having entered the portal, and Duke suing Mensa, and it's just it's craziness, right? It's wild time when I think about visiting there and how excited, you know, Coach Manny Diaz and all those guys were about them. But it's I guess the nature that we're in is you've got no longer you just have coaches leaving and taking players. Now you've got quarterbacks leaving and taking players, perhaps with the quarterbacks to another school. So we see in the NFL, right? We see in the NFL happen a little bit.
But it's like college, old guys who used to play with Aaron Rodgers.
Yeah, right. Yeah, not quite like this.
A little
bit
different.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
This is gonna be fascinating to watch. I'm with you, Ross. I think at the point they're at now, because maybe a judge will say that Darian Mensa can't enroll in another college. Maybe he'll enjoin him from enrolling somewhere besides Duke, but I don't see that. I don't see that happening. Yeah. I think it's a pretty far bridge, and obviously that would get appealed. And I don't know.
And I don't know the specifics around Cooper's contract, but the fact that Duke isn't, they're not, it doesn't seem like they're providing,
they're fighting him.
Yeah, right. fighting him legally, which tells me that he probably just signed a 1-year deal, like many players do. And Mensa's situation is different because he signed a 2-year deal. He was going into his second year of the contract.
Mm-hmm. Which I think that's another thing a lot of people don't realize is they're, because, you know, you see people say, well, they need to be able to sign multi-year contracts. They can, and they do. This is happening. And it's not always happening. Sometimes either the player or the school wants the flexibility of the 1-year deal. But it is happening with some of these bigger ones where if somebody has 2 years of eligibility remaining, they sign a 2-year contract. So it's just a matter of whether those contracts hold up. And we're going to find out about this one because there's a hearing scheduled. We'll see if they get to it. Perhaps there's a financial settlement, but it's going to be interesting to see how it's resolved either way. Now, when we come back, maybe an even more interesting story. We delve into the world of college basketball, well, because it'll affect college football eventually too. Charles Bediako. You probably didn't know who that was yesterday. Everybody in college sports knows who he is right now. We'll talk about him next. We are back at the College Football Inquirer, and for a moment, we'll become the College Basketball Inquirer because we have to talk about Charles Bediako. The best way to start this is just this. Charles Bediako played at Alabama as a freshman in the 2022-23 season. He then declared for the NBA draft. He was a member of the San Antonio Spurs organization. He played for for their summer league team. He played for their G League team. He's then bounced around a little bit in the G League last season to different franchises. And now he wants to play college basketball again, which we've been told for pretty much the entirety of the existence of college sports that you can't do that. That if you sign a pro contract, you can't come back. But a judge has issued a 10-day temporary restraining order pending a hearing that is scheduled for next week that allows Charles Bediako to participate in basketball with Alabama. They play a game against Tennessee on Saturday. Don't know if he's going to be in that game or not, but obviously every coach, every athletic director is watching this thing, because if you could just go get a guy from the G League who doesn't feel like his NBA prospects are all that great, well, that changes the math on everything.
Yeah, it's wild. I was texting somebody yesterday about this. I was messaging with somebody about the Trinidad Chambliss appeal for his eligibility. And the person said, man, we've moved on to Alabama. Like, if we moved on to this other thing. It's like every day there's something new. By the way, the Trinidad Chambliss appeal could be heard Friday, could be reviewed Friday. There's a chance it goes another week. And there's a hearing on that, right, in a week or two, maybe, in state court in Mississippi. But that's one eligibility case, and we're talking here about this other eligibility case, which is fascinating. I think that you've seen a few coaches, you know, Mark Pope, I think, of Kentucky, said this yesterday after a game is, you know what, if judges are going to keep on ruling for players to basically break NCAA rules, which this eligibility case would be doing, then the NCAA should step up and just say, you know what, if you play this player, your games in which he played won't count, or something like that, or you won't qualify for the NCAA tournament. Basically some kind of punitive action on the school.
Right.
And I'm here to tell everybody, you can't do that, because it's in the court order. Right. And I did see Dave Benedict also, I think, told ESPN something similar, the UConn AD, who's on the academic eligibility committee. And that would make a lot of sense. I understand why people are suggesting this, but it's in the court order that the NCAA is precluded from doing that, from taking any kind of punitive action. So that can't really happen. What needs to happen, Andy, is coaches, especially coaches and athletic administrators at schools who have been fairly public with everybody following the rules, need to stop supporting athletes who request court orders that break the rules. And that is what needs to happen. And that's hard to do when everybody won't do it, though, right? When everybody won't do it, it's hard for one school to say, well, we're going to play by the rules. We're not going to support this, when their rivals are doing it. So you're in a competitive market right now where you have everybody not sort of following the rules, in certain schools supporting athletes to break the rules through a court action. And so it's a difficult spot. And it kind of makes this messy environment that we're in.
This is a different situation than the athlete compensation stuff, the eligibility stuff. I've said this multiple times on the show. I actually think if the NCAA wanted to fight that through the federal court system on antitrust grounds, they can win that one. Because I do think, as we've learned, the end consumer did not care one bit about whether they were getting paid or how much they were getting paid. But I do think the end consumer does have an expectation that college athletes are kind of the usual cohort of college students, at least in terms of age and experience. And so this rule, which we consider a bedrock rule of college sports, that once you go pro, you can't go back to college, I think the end consumer probably would support that. And so if you were the NCAA and the schools and you wanted to make a pro-competitive argument for having that rule, for, you know, for acting, you know, unilaterally as a cartel and creating that rule because it makes your product better, differentiates your product from other things in the marketplace, I think they could win that. I really do.
Yeah.
But I understand why they would be a little bit scared to fight it, because they have gotten their clocks cleaned in federal court over the compensation stuff. Obviously, a CBA would solve this. You could have rules that establish your, and like, look, the NFL and NBA eligibility rules have held up in court. Maurice Claret challenged the NFL's, which was collectively bargained, not by Maurice Claret, and it held up in court. So if you wanted to have something like this, you could. Ross, people, why is this happening now? I'll tell you why it's happening now. Because let's say you're a judge. You could be a judge. Take aside, you know, venue shopping, you know, judges having allegiances, that sort of thing. But let's say you're a judge in some random state or in some random federal court circuit who doesn't follow this stuff at all. Is there any distinction to you between Alabama paying Charles Bediako and the San Antonio Spurs paying Charles Bediako to play basketball?
Right. It comes down to money, right? And I wrote this last week in for 1-3 or my weekly sports business column of the NCAA's, from the NCAA convention, of the NCAA's just sort of vexing eligibility issue that it faces. And part of it is because players who may never be able to, and Bediako is maybe a good example, may never be able to play, you know, 1 minute or even a couple games in the NBA or get drafted in the NFL, are now making the kind of money that you can make in the pros in college. And so if they can't play in the pros
or more, a good college basketball player makes more than a G League player.
Yeah. So that's what's changed, right? And that's why a lot of these suits are being brought in, the ones that are having success, which we've seen plenty get denied at the federal level. And now, right now, all these lawyers have wised up and they're starting to file in state court, more local court, where you have judges who maybe are more willing to side with their state school and state school's athletes, as opposed to on the federal level. So you're starting to see that more, and you're starting to, you know, judges are probably using as a reasoning, and players certainly are when they file these lawsuits, of, hey, what the NCAA is keeping us from making money, like a lot of money. So that's been the real big difference. And Andy, the NCAA has been fighting for a congressional bill to protect, protect, you know, it from enforcing its laws now for 6 years.
Or to allow it to break the Sherman Antitrust Act. Yes.
Antitrust rules, right. In this issue with the eligibility, I think is probably getting more attention from lawmakers than any of, we need to probably do something here.
If they wanted to pass something to give them a limited antitrust exemption on the eligibility front.
Yeah.
I think the public probably is cool with that. I think probably that, and like I said, I think if they fought it, because obviously that would eventually get challenged in court, I think they could fight that and win in court. And it's not like the pay stuff, which you have a really hard time justifying. Though our producer TJ asked a really interesting question. I think there's probably a lot of people listening and watching who have the same question. Would athletes being paid now and feeling almost semi-pro change the public opinion on quote-unquote pro athletes being able to come back? I don't think it would, because I think the public opinion is that they want college students playing college sports. That's part of the whole appeal of it. But I will push back on something TJ asked about college sports being almost semi-pro, quote, almost semi-pro. No. It's professional sports.
If I pay you to play basketball, you're a
professional basketball player. If I pay you to play football, you're a professional football player. What is the difference between the San Antonio Spurs business model and the Alabama Athletic Department's business model? The San Antonio Spurs pay people to play basketball, and they sell tickets to basketball games, and they sell television broadcast rights to basketball games through the NBA. What does the University of Alabama Athletic Department do? It pays people to play basketball and football. It sells tickets to basketball and football games. It sells television rights to basketball and football games through the SEC. They're the same business.
Yeah. Yeah, the only difference, right?
Judges are not seeing a distinction.
There's one difference, right? And it's that the tether to a university. That's about it. And that tether is, as it has been for the last really 10 to 15 years, it's been stressed and kind of breaking apart. You know, it's loosening, you might say, is the think about a rope from being tied to college athletics, athletic departments in a university, and that rope is starting to get really thin and stretched as these two entities move further and further apart from one another. And everybody wants to keep that, most people, I think, want to keep that rope intact, and it's just being more and more difficult to do.
And I think the eligibility rules are a way to do that. And I that's what I would say if I were to give advice to the people in charge of college sports. Stop fighting over the money. You're never going to win that one.
Yeah.
But fight for the eligibility rules. You got a shot there.
Yeah. We'll see.
But it'll be fascinating. Like Charles Bediako plays against Tennessee. Holy crap. That's going to be crazy. Because that's the thing I kept coming back to on Wednesday, Ross. Like we were talking about it on my On Three show. And every time my producer popped up a picture of Charles Bediako, it was him like in a Spurs uniform or in a Pistons uniform because he played in their organization for a little while too.
Yeah.
And like when I was trying to do some research on it and make sure I was pronouncing Charles Bediako's last name properly, the place I found the proper pronunciation was a clip of a summer league game where Charles Bediako is playing for the Spurs summer league team against the Thunder. And it's like, oh my God, this guy might play Tennessee for Alabama.
I think he signed three separate contracts in pro basketball. And the NCAA came out with a pretty stern statement about that a few days ago, citing the three contracts and wanting to protect, obviously, college basketball and high school recruiting and all that stuff. It'd be pretty crazy if he ends up playing, and it'll be. This is going to be an interesting one to watch down the stretch here.
So Saturday, in case you're wondering what you're going to do this weekend, Tennessee, Alabama, coming at you from Tuscaloosa, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time on ESPN. I think there's going to be a lot of ADs and administrators tuned in, or at least checking it on their phone to see who's in the lineup for the Tide on that one. When we come back, when next you hear us, it will be Tuesday. So the schedule has changed. The season is over, so we're now on a Tuesday-Thursday publication schedule. But when we come back, Godfrey will have returned. We have a lot to talk about. We still need to clean up a little bit of the Big Ten SEC loggerheads, but not just in the boardroom. We need to talk about the Big Ten and the SEC and how they are viewed on the field in football. And maybe should that change? Should that be viewed a little differently going forward? We can take a look at some of the futures for the national championship and how they shake out. Because I think the mindset is beginning to turn a little bit. And we'll talk about that when Godfrey comes back. And of course, we may have an outcome in this Darian Mensah saga. The news never stops. College football never stops. We'll talk to you on Tuesday.